Hello, dear listeners from all over the universe. This is the Moment of Truth with D, Debunking Doctor, 3D, and I'm your host, 3D actually. Okay, well, there's something amazing about today's episode in that I am not the only person on this episode. I have a specialist with me. Remember that I said from the last episode that I would try to bring in a specialist just to answer some questions that might stem from the last episode. And yes, I had questions. Oh, a good number of them. And yes, I tried and it worked out. And today I have a specialist with me to answer all of those questions and perhaps say more. I mean, go beyond just answering the questions. Okay, so before I go into anything else, I want to say a very huge thank you to everyone that listened to the last episode, came up with questions. I mean, took out time to actually send those questions to me. I want to say thank you very much. Thank you for your time. Thank you for, you know, using your data in that regard, you know, to learn and to improve. I want to say thank you very much. Okay, so before I go into the details of today, you know, before we go into the very depth of today's discussion, I would just go off on the regular 1 minute break, you know, that 1 minute break that is supposed to encourage someone, you know, to get on this platform and do something. You remember? Yes. Okay, so I'm going to just do that quickly in 1 minute, and before you know it, I'll be back. Welcome back. Okay, so without wasting more time, we're going to go straight to my conversation with the specialist, and it's going to be like a question and answer session, so you likely hear my questions first and then you hear his answers to them, and that's the way it will, I mean, I would run it for today's episode. And so I'm going to just begin. I need to pull you closer so that you get to know my guest today. And so, the first question is, sir, can you please introduce yourself?
Okay, I'm Kolade Ojeremi. I'm still under training. I'm undergoing my specialist training in the specialty of obstetrics and gynecology at the University College of Ibadan.
Thank you so much, and I'm super excited because I know there's so much to learn from you. And I really do hope that my listeners are as excited. I guess that. So I'll not want to waste your time at all. I'm just going to go straight to the questions that I have. Off we go. The very first question that I have with me here, sir, is that, are there non-laboratory ways by which an individual, of course a woman now, can perceive ovulation?
Yes, there are. But at this point, I think we need to be aware of both the non-laboratory and the laboratory ways to confirm ovulation in any woman. Well, for the non-laboratory ways, which I think a lot of women really need to know about, are common things, are things that a lot of people actually notice, but probably just don't pay so much attention to those things. Okay. First and foremost, there's something we call mucus, cervical mucus. You know, there is a change that usually occurs when ovulation takes place. And this change is due to the effect of progesterone. There's this cervical mucus that most women notice. The mucus is usually clear, is non-offensive. It can be stretched. It's more like mucus and not just ordinary water.
Okay.
The main difference is that it can stretch. If you put it in between two fingers and you try to stretch it, it will not break easily.
Okay.
Yes. So that is one of the main non-laboratory signs that you can see or you can notice. Then there are some other changes like lower abdominal pain. Some call it mid-cycle pain or ovulation pain or meteshmas. I'm trying to use terminologies that most people that's probably not even in the medical sector will understand. The
Okay.
pain can be similar to menstrual pain, but the difference is
Okay.
that it usually occurs most of the time at the middle of the cycle. Yes. And it can radiate to any of the sides and even sometimes to the back. But most people actually cope well with this pain. And you don't even need to use any pain relief or any analgesic for the pain to subside. Then there are some other non-specific symptoms. These symptoms are similar to premenstrual symptoms, meaning that symptoms that most women notice before they start menstruation. And these symptoms
Okay.
include fullness of the breasts or tenderness sometimes. The breast can be full or even get painful. You
Okay.
know, so that's actually another sign that a woman can notice. Then sometimes some even have like mild spotting. They can spot. And some will even think that is it that they want to start menstruating again? Or it may even look like a brownish discharge. But the good thing about it is that it will be non-offensive, unlike if a woman has an infection, you know. So that's another thing. But and some other women too usually have some changes in their libido. There is a slight increase in libido, you know. They try to feel, they tend to feel horny and all that. That can also be a sign of ovulation. Then occasionally, some people have heightened sense of smell, just like a pregnant woman. You know, they smell things easily. You know, so that can also be a sign of ovulation. Then for the laboratory part, I just said I will quickly talk about. Well, this has to do more with doctors and maybe nurses and all that, maybe health care practitioners, but I think women too should know about this. There's something we call follicular tracking. It's a form of ultrasound that we tell women to do. We tell them to do it some days before the expected day of ovulation. It's just for us to be able to monitor the maturation of the follicles and when the follicle ruptures. Right? So that's what follicular tracking talks about. It's just about monitoring the follicles until it ruptures and the egg is released. And that's just basically what ovulation means. Ovulation simply means release of an egg or oocyte from the ovary, right? That's follicular tracking. Then there's also a blood test that can be done. Progesterone is a common, is one of the hormonal tests that we do for women. There is a minimum amount that is required for us to confirm if a woman has ovulated or not. Then basal body temperature. Temperature talks about measuring. A woman should actually have an idea of how her body feels like or how warm her body is. So if she notices maybe like an increase in the body temperature, that may also be a pointer. Though that does not really help in this environment because of wear and other conditions that can cause temperature, increased temperature. Thank you.
All right, sir.
Well, follicles are just like the basic units of the ovary. The ovary is like a structure, it's like an organ. Okay, a woman has, let's talk about, quickly talk about the reproductive system of a woman. A woman has a womb called uterus. We call it womb in a layman's language, womb. Then the womb has an opening called cervix. Then there are two ropes that are attached to the womb called fallopian tubes. Then hanging on those two ropes are structures on both sides called ovaries. So for each of those, for the ovaries, they are made up of many follicles. Many follicles. Then each follicle now has millions of eggs inside of them. right? So what I tried explaining the other time was that the ultrasound is used to localize the follicles, then now monitor them as they mature, then rupture. So it's actually the follicles that rupture to release the eggs inside of them. Then I wanted to say something. Lastly, the absolute evidence of ovulation, the absolute thing that you can use to confirm if a woman is ovulating is pregnancy. A woman that gets pregnant means that she is ovulating. Yes.
Well, I'm really convinced that whoever asked that question is super satisfied now. I mean, with that answer. Thank you very much for that, sir. The next question that I have here says that at what time really will it be getting too late for a woman to do childbearing? Okay. In other words, when is it medically recommended that a lady should do childbearing?
Well, thank you for the question. According to the World Health Organization, there is actually an age group to represent women in their reproductive age group or the reproductive life. And this age range is between 15 and 49 years. Okay. 15 and 49 years. But from studies and all that have been done, well, it's been suggested that the best reproductive age group is between 20 to 24 years. But we all know that because of the structure of our education and all that, the educational system, that may not be very feasible, because between that age group, most people are probably still in tertiary institution.
Okay.
You know, yeah. So, but 15 to 49 years is the age of a reproductive woman.
Is there anything like age range of reproduction for a man?
Wow. not that I know of. And there's a king that we all know. I don't want to mention names.
Okay.
That we all know. That is in his 80s already, and in fact, he's been having set of twins.
Okay.
You know? So okay. There is really no age group. Okay. There is really no age group for a man.
Okay. All right. The next question here, sir, is about IVF. The next couple of questions, actually. Yeah, so I'm just going to read out everything and let you answer, all of those questions together, since they are all around the same subject. The first is, what other options are available to couples that are trying to conceive apart from IVF? The next question is, can you elaborate more on IVF? I heard someone can use donor eggs and sperms, etc. Will the mother's body not reject the baby like that, since it is not her egg? And then the last on that same subject is that, is there anything that a couple should do to increase success with IVF? Because I heard it fails too.
If a couple, right, are not able to get pregnant by themselves, if pregnancy does not occur, then the other option, the other broad option, is what we call assisted conception or assisted reproductive technology. And IVF is just one of those techniques, because most of the time people think it's only IVF, right? So the other options now, one of them is either donation of the ovum or sperm. And I think that was one of the questions you asked me, that can, for people that want to do IVF, that is there a role for them to get donors and all that? Yes, we definitely do that. It depends on so many factors. Like for a woman that is above 35, we usually advise that the woman should go for egg donor, should get donation of egg, because at after age 35, the quality of the egg is not so good again, and that may actually affect the success of IVF.
Mm.
So for a woman that is above 35, we actually advise that the woman should go for donation. Then there are some other factors that we also consider. For a woman that, from our evaluation and all that, we feel that the egg, in terms of our ovarian reserve, if we think that the quality is not good again, and which is, that also usually happens after the age of 35, you know, we also advise the woman that it's better to go for. But we've seen patients or women that are even after 35. In fact, there was a woman that I heard about, she was 55 or thereabout, and it was her egg that was, she insisted she wanted her egg, and it worked out, you know. So, but we just give, because considering the cost and all that, we try to give women the best advice, so that at least that will increase the chance of, or the success rate of IVF, right? Then for men, during the course of evaluation, there are some men that they don't really have a good quality sperm in terms of the motility, the morphology, or even sperm count.
Okay.
I've seen someone that had azoospermia. Azoospermia means that there was no spermatozoa at all, you know. So for such a man, for him to probably impregnate a woman, he needs sperm donation.
Okay.
You know, so, but looking at this, the way most fertility centers do it now, you know, they've really standardized most of these things. We do it in such a way that you won't even know, you will not know the person that probably donated either the egg or the spermatozoa most of the time, so that the person will not come up later in life to say that maybe he's the father of the child or something. So you won't even get to know who has donated the egg or the sperm out here. So I think that's sort out that. Then the other option is intrauterine insemination. That one is usually done for, like, maybe a man that has a low sperm count, or maybe the morphology, we say oligozoospermia, the count is not good enough, you know. Yeah, for such a man, we can assist by inseminating, by putting the sperm herself into the uterus of the woman, into the womb of the woman, just to facilitate fertilization, to facilitate, yes, the man's sperm to put into the uterus of his wife or the partner. No. So that's intrauterine insemination. Then there are some other things. There's one we call gifts, gamete intrafallopian tube transfer. What that means is that gamete just talks about transferring, gamete talks about either the egg or the sperm, transferring those two into the tube for fertilization to take place, because fertilization takes place in the tube. So it's as if we are trying to assist the couple, you know, by getting egg from the woman, then sperm from the man or a donor, then we'll transfer it into the tube for fertilization to take place. And it's also similar to what we call ZIFT. That one is the zygote intrafallopian tube transfer. That one is a bit similar to IVF, because fertilization will take place in vitro, meaning outside, just the way we do IVF. So after zygote has been formed, because when an egg and a sperm comes together, spermatozoa, it forms a zygote. So it's that zygote that will transfer into the tube. So the difference between this ZIFT that I've talked about and IVF is that in IVF, zygote is transferred into the womb, But in Zift, the zygote is transferred into the tube. That's just the difference. Yes, that's the difference for that. Okay. Then the other option is cryopreservation. This cryopreservation is actually meant for people that have maybe a chronic medical illness. Let's say there's a young lady that has maybe a cancer of the womb, or even cancer of the ovary, or cancer of any part of her body that we think can affect the ovary over time. We harvest some eggs from the ovary and preserve it, so that after doing the surgery and all that, she can still have access to the ovaries for her to at least be able to do IVF later in life, you know. And that can be done for a man too. The sperm can also be stored for so many years. Then there's also something we call surrogacy, right? I think somebody asked about the question.
Yes, I have a question on that. Surrogacy.
So surrogacy just simply means that it's just like a process. It just means that a woman like carries a pregnancy, but that woman does not have the intention to actually take care or raise the child after birth. Okay. That's what surrogacy just means. Okay.
Yes.
Right? Let's say a couple has challenge. They have challenge with getting pregnant and all that, right? There's something we call commercial surrogacy, whereby they will pay somebody. So they can look for somebody that they trust, someone that is probably a lot younger, that can carry the pregnancy for them. Of course, there will be documents and all that will be signed, so that there won't be issues later in life. Then she carries the pregnancy till she delivers. But our work ends just after delivery, because the baby will be handed over to the couple, that actually started up the whole thing. Then the last one that I know a lot of people shy away from is adoption. Mm. If one is not able to do all those other options, then the option of adoption can actually be explored. Right. Okay. Then for the process of IVF. IVF is called in vitro fertilization. I've talked a little about it, that you get an egg from a woman or a donor, then sperm from a woman or a donor. You fertilize it outside in a medium.
Yes.
Right? So when it forms a zygote, then the zygote is transferred. We call that embryo transfer.
Okay.
It's transferred into the uterus. Then after that is done, there are some other drugs that we'll give just to support the pregnancy. We call it, most of the time, is like a form of, we call it luteal phase support, like a form of progesterone that we give just to support the pregnancy. The aim of this is that we're just trying to mimic the natural or spontaneous conception. That's just what IVF means. It's like you're trying to mimic everything about conception. Another example that is similar to that is induction of labor. If a woman does not fall into spontaneous labor, we can induce labor for the woman for her to start contracting. So that's just, they are quite synonymous in terms of spontaneous conception and assisted conception.
Thank you very much.
A lot of times we don't have to start, we don't look for people that have a DNA compatibility and all that. We actually don't do that most of the time. We don't do that. And rejection, you know, because I understand what's the concern of the person, that we can rejection take place, like for people that have organ transplants, like kidney transplants, that, you know, there will be rejection, the body will start reacting to it and all that. But IVF is not really like that. And that's why we have drugs. We have drugs that are given to try, and it's like you are trying to modulate something, you know? So there is really no concern about having issues with DNA incompatibility. There's really no issue about that. And sometimes we even do washings if it's necessary for us to do. Let's say, for example, a woman has maybe HIV or something, you know, and she wants to use the she wants to use her egg, you know, there are washings that we can do. We can even wash sperm too, you know, at least to try and reduce all those infections, contagious infections and all that. So there's really no cause for alarm.
Okay, sir. Thank you very much for that. And then the last questions. Well, the two last questions are around fibroids. And then this listener would like to know that after fibroid surgery, when should a woman resume sexual intercourse? When should she resume, sexual intimacy with her husband, having had fibroid surgery?
Okay, thank you for the question. Well, it actually depends on some factors,
okay,
right? It depends on the extent of the surgery that was done.
Okay.
And it also depends on the age of the woman. For example, if fibroid surgery called myomectomy, if it was done for a lady that is still about 24 or thereabouts, you know, such a woman, we might tell her to wait for about 9 months, 9 to 12 months. Mm-hmm. Yes. We might tell her to wait for about 9 to 12 months. But if it's someone that is already in maybe late 30s or early 40s,
9 months.
Most of the time we tell them just to wait for 3 months. We just say at least 3 months. And you know, I said there is a second part to it, the extent of the surgery. The uterus has three layers. The innermost layer, three layers, yes. The womb has three layers. The innermost layer is called the endometrium. If the endometrium was breached during surgery, if it was broken, like if we had to go through the endometrium to remove some fibroids, we actually tell people to wait for a longer period, meaning that the 3 months would be with caution. And the reason for that is that if we do myomectomy and the endometrium, the innermost part was breached, then we usually advise the person to wait for maybe like at least 6 months, with the fact that the person will have to deliver by elective cesarean section. We have to choose a date for her to deliver by cesarean section because there is the risk of the uterus tearing. That's what we call uterine rupture, which can occur during pregnancy or when the woman is in labor. So we don't want such a woman to even go into labor at all. We just counsel her and book her for elective cesarean section.
Okay. Thank you very much for that. So the last question, sir, is still on fibroids. And then it says, what can be done if pregnancy does not result after a fibroid surgery?
Yeah, thank you for that question too. Well, this actually does not have a common ground in court. People have different schools of thought, because in the real sense, some schools of thought actually believe that fibroid in itself does not cause infertility. Yes, that it is just only associated with infertility. And what that simply means is that we've seen cases that, you know, they've been trying to get pregnant and after doing a fibroid surgery, the woman gets pregnant. But we've also seen cases that even after the fibroid surgery, pregnancy still does not come. And what that just simply means is that there are so many factors that need to be considered when it comes to conception. You have to consider the woman, you have to consider the man. And even apart from that, there is also something we call unexplained infertility. You've investigated the woman, everything comes out fine. Investigated the man, everything comes out fine. and the pregnancy still does not come, you know. So even after having myomectomy, you know, there are still some other things we need to do, meaning that the woman should be evaluated at least to ascertain if the uterus is good enough for pregnancy, to ascertain if the tubes, if they are patent and they are in good condition, and to also ascertain if the ovaries are working well, and to also be sure that there are no pelvic factors. What I mean by pelvic factors, there are two common conditions that actually cause or that are responsible for what we call pelvic factors. Pelvic inflammatory disease, which also affects the tube, then endometriosis, which can also affect the ovaries. It can affect the pelvis as a whole, then the ovaries and some other structures, then pelvic inflammatory disease, which can affect the pelvis and the tubes. You know, so all those other things too need to be evaluated. Then for the man, a semen analysis.
Okay, so I think that's just basically, so if a couple has had, if a woman has had surgery or fibroid surgery and she's still not pregnant, after fulfilling all the necessary conditions, because in fact, at this point, I need to mention those conditions. There's something we call regular unprotected sexual intercourse. What we mean by regular is that a couple must have intercourse at least 3 times a week, 3 times a week on different days. There are 7 days in a week. So a couple is expected to have intercourse at least 3 times a week on different days. That's the first thing. Then the second thing is that the intercourse should also be timed, meaning that every woman should understand her menstrual cycle and her ovulation period when she ovulates. Because that ovulation period, some days before and some days after, is what we call fertile period. And that's the most likely period that a woman can get pregnant. Right. Okay. So so I think that's just... Yes, then I talked about unprotected. I've seen occasions, it happens once in a while, that a couple is trying to get pregnant, but in the real sense, I think it's women that do this most of the time. The woman is probably actually on a form of contraception.
Okay.
She doesn't want to get pregnant at that point. The husband wants the pregnancy by all means. Such a woman cannot get pregnant.
Okay.
Or for people that are using, you know, condom, I mean, pregnancy cannot come. So that's what we mean by unprotected. You must not be on any form of contraception or anything that can reduce the possibility of getting pregnant.
Okay.
Then I also want to chip in something about the regularity. I also noticed that for couples that don't stay together, they also have a reduced chance of getting pregnant.
Okay.
Because let's say the man works in Lagos, the woman is in Ibadan, you know, and the man comes back to Ibadan on Friday, maybe Friday evening, and by Sunday evening, he's back to Lagos. There's a very high possibility that they will not meet during our fertile period. And most of the time, looking at it Friday, you'll probably be tired on that Friday. They'll probably just meet on Saturday and maybe on Sunday. So you can see that that's just like twice a week. So that's another thing that needs to be considered. There are occasions that people will have to come together just for them to be able to achieve conception. Yeah.
Okay, thank you very much, sir. So from that last question, I mean, the question you just answered, you mentioned something that I find very important. And that's about, you know, the woman does not want to get pregnant yet. The man wants the pregnancy. And then the woman has to, you know, find a way of preventing pregnancy. I just want to know that, you know, from your years of experience, why do you think that couples get to this point? And why do you think that, okay, a woman would have to resort to, I mean, doing that without the knowledge of her husband, you know? And how do you think this problem can be solved? You know, yes, we all know that there should be no secrets in the family and all of that, but I really want to, I don't want to just generalize or give, you know, a general word. And I also would not want, you know, any listener, maybe a male listener, to go out there and then be like, oh, I hope you are not using any form of contraception. I hope that is not the reason you're not getting pregnant and all of that. And then, you know, I wouldn't want any form of misinformation, okay, from this interaction. I just want, I would like you, sir, to help, you know, make that clearer to people out there. Why would that come into a family, and how can it be tackled? How can that be solved without any problems, and then without any form of trouble, okay, with the home?
Okay, well, that's an interesting question.
Maybe that is not exactly.
Yeah, because that has some social. it's not, but it's still part. It's still part of gynecology, you know. And that is why, as much as possible, we usually advise people, you know, when I mean people that are into relationships and all that, for them to have a common ground. These are issues that should have been sorted out during their courtship. You know, some, you know, we have different background. Some people believe that when they get married, maybe in the first 1 year, they should not get pregnant, just for them to know their spouse very well. You get? So, and sometimes some people, it's just because of the nature of their work. Maybe they are working in a bank or somewhere that they've given them instruction that you cannot get pregnant during this period, and the partner will not want to understand that. He doesn't see any reason why. In fact, some will even say the wife should live where they are working, that he can, you know, cope with them not working. But we all understand all these social issues. You know, so most of the time, of course, the woman is actually the patient of the gynecologist. And you have to maintain some level of confidentiality. So there are some questions, or there are some things we discuss with the woman, or there are some things we prefer to discuss with the woman in the absence of her husband. So there are some times we actually tell the husband to excuse us. So at that point, we just try to talk, you know, we just talk to them. You have to be a bit diplomatic too. We talk to them, make them understand, you know, they have to come to a common ground. They have to agree. You know, can two work together except they agree? So they have to come together. And there's a limit to what a doctor can do, you know, when it comes to that. Okay. Yeah. Another thing we notice is that it's like a lot of women don't actually prepare for pregnancy, both physically and psychologically. Pregnancy has a lot of psychological issues, you know, because a woman tends to feel like she's not as attractive, you know, so many issues. Some of her dresses will not size her again, and so many other factors. So a woman needs to prepare herself psychologically. That is just for a period of time. You know, that is just for a period of time. That things would, even if it does not return exactly to her pre-pregnancy state, but at least she's still going to feel like the babe, you know. She's still going to feel good. Yes. It's something that is very important, yes. Because I know a lot of women have issues and all that. But I think people are getting better now, because the way women dress to antenatal clinic and all that. I think it's getting better. Then what I mean by the physical aspect is that every woman that is actually preparing to get pregnant should at least start using folic acid 3 months before conception. Because that helps in preventing a lot of congenital anomalies, especially what we call neural tube defects, you know. So that helps it, because a lot of first trimester miscarriages have been associated with this or related to this. So, I mean, some of those things can be avoided. Just folic acid, one tablet daily. It's very cheap. Folic acid is cheap. You know, then we should also eat healthy meals as much as possible, you know, fruits, vegetables, and all that. Then for those that have medical conditions, they must be sure or they must see specialists that can actually control the medical condition well, irrespective of the medical condition, be it hypertension, elevated blood pressure, diabetes. Some are on anticonvulsants. Some of those anticonvulsants are not safe in pregnancy, especially the early part of pregnancy. Some anticonvulsants, some drugs, some anti-diabetic drugs in quotes, all those oral hypoglycemic agents, some of them are not safe. And even some hypertensive, antihypertensives, some of them are not safe.
Okay.
Meaning that for people that are on those drugs, at least when you know you are preparing to get pregnant, you should see a specialist that will advise you on what to do. Because for some of those drugs, immediately you get to know you are pregnant, you have to stop them. Yes. So that it does not affect the most important part of the baby, called the embryogenic period. That's when all the different parts of the body of the baby is formed. So that's just basically what preconception care entails. We call it preconception care.
Thank you so much, Dr. J. May God bless you very much. Thank you for the many things that you discussed with us today. Thank you for sharing them with us. Well, I would just say that having said all of that, what is your farewell message? I mean, to couples out there that are trying to conceive, to people that are looking forward to getting married someday, you know, to anyone at all that might at some point be faced with, I mean, the questions or the problems of infertility.
Well, my farewell message is that it's definitely not too late. And I strongly believe that for two people to come together, that means that they were first friends before they got married. So they should just see it as one of the challenges in life. They have to stick together. It should not be a blame game, even if it's obvious that the man is the cause of the infertility or the woman. There should not be any blame game, because even some family members sometimes will throw some things at you, will tell you to go and try outside. You know, so as much as possible, you have to make it. In fact, it should just be between both of you and your doctor. It's not something you have to let people know, you know, because it will make you better. It will make you better. It would make your marriage even last. Because
by the time you wait, right?
And as much as possible, it's a time for both of you. It's actually a building time. It's for both of you to know yourselves better before children start coming in and all that. You know? So just keep trying. But I also tell people, with the advent of IVF, I don't usually advise for people to stay for so many years. A couple called me some months ago, and they've been married. I got to know they've been married for like over 30 years. The wife is now almost 60, and you know, they are trying to do IVF and all that. Well, at this point in time, I don't think people should really stay for that long again. You know? So, but in all, let's just commit everything to God. Because I believe that with God, all things are possible.
I picked a number of things from that, actually. You know, that with God, all things are possible. And yes, with Him, all things are possible. I mean, sometimes even medical doctors cannot explain certain things. And if you remember, one thing that Dr. JME mentioned is that sometimes an infertility is deemed unexplained because the man and the woman are deemed fit. you know, to get pregnant, and yet pregnancy is not happening. Okay, so with God, all things are possible. Things that we cannot explain as humans, God can definitely explain. Okay, and outside that, he also said that infertility should not be a blame game. Okay, it's a time for growth for the couples. It's a time for them to, you know, come to understand each other better and to build a really strong home, even as they fight, I mean, through that time of infertility, to a point where they both win. And of course, you know, they can enjoy the victory together. Well, I hope you were able to pick some other things. And on this note, I want to say a very big thank you to Dr. Jayemi. Thank you so much for, I mean, giving me this time for, you know, coming here to let us know this truth about the subject of infertility. Thank you very much, sir. God bless you and God bless your home. And to every listener, because really, for you to ask any question, it means that you listened. I mean, to the previous episode, I want to say thank you very much for taking out time to listen. To everyone that listened. And then, of course, to everyone that took out time to, you know, write down their questions, send them to me, forward them to me. And, of course, made today's episode a possibility, a reality. I want to say thank you very much. And I really do hope that all of your questions have been answered well, in great ways, right? Okay, so on this note, I'm just going to wish you a really wonderful new week, okay, as we look forward to it, and I hope you'll enjoy your weekend too, while you remember to share this with your loved ones. I wish you a really wonderful life out there, and to every couple that are trying to conceive, well, stay strong. It will end in praise. It will end well for you and for your partner. Have a really wonderful week, everyone. Bye.